Okay.
This working? This working? This working? Nope. How about now?
How about now? How about now? Oh. How about now? That sounds good. Okay. So we were deep into energy metabolism last time. Gotten two-thirds of the way through the most efficient way of getting glucose, having glucose give us energy in the presence of oxygen. And let's see here. Okay, so one of my last slides was the electron transport chain. Lights down. I'm getting a late start. Where little packets of energy rather than the full 53 kilocalories per mole, that's inherent in the transformation of NADH2, taking those electrons and passing them to oxygen, is broken down into a bunch of thermodynamically favored delta G release, delta G not releasing steps of lower magnitude in these complexes 1, 3, and 4 of proteins that are located very especially and essentially in the inner membrane of the mitochondrion, if you're in an animal cell or a plant cell, a eukaryotic cell. The electron transport chain, complex 1, complex 2, complex 3, just arranged pretty much like this. Not only remember that this mitochondrion is full of these cristae, and so the outside of the cell is still over here, and those little rectangles are the electron transport chains all over the place, mixed with these lollipops. Okay, let's get a closer view of that, of an artist's depiction. Actually, the structures of these things are pretty well known. Each complex consists of many proteins, several proteins, maybe, I don't know, 5 to 10. And here we have complex 1. The electrons get in. They're transferred to coenzyme Q, or ubiquinone, which, because of its 50 hydrocarbon carbons, floats in the membrane. Diffuses over to complex 3, where it gives up the electrons here. And so the electron transport chain, with all its steps indicated on the previous, in slide 1, and now on slide 3, finally goes to complex 4, where it gives up the electrons to oxygen. Now, what's remarkable about this process is that as the electrons are bound by these proteins, they're they cause a structural conformational change in the protein. And that energy that's inherent in the transfer of the electrons is used to induce this conformational change. And this conformational change, in turn, is used as a pump, to pump against the equilibrium situation of protons on both sides of the membrane. Here, the matrix side on the bottom. Here, the intermembrane space, but I think it's even better just to think of it as the outside. Right? So protons are pumped. Here it's obvious there is a proton, although there are really two protons here, right? Four protons are pumped here. Over in some of these other complexes, it's only like iron that's binding an electron, no proton involved. So these are not the protons that are involved, the very protons that came on the NADH to begin with. They're just protons grabbed from the matrix solution from water, from the 10 to the minus 7th equilibrium that would be if it were neutral, and they are pumped outside, right? Until, in fact, a higher concentration is built up outside, or maybe a better way to think of it is a lower concentration is produced inside because of this pumping action. The result is that there's a gradient of about one pH unit between the outside of the membrane and the inside of the membrane. One pH unit is a big deal because that's about a tenfold higher concentration of hydrogen ions outside than inside. Or again, a better way to think of it maybe is a tenfold dearth of protons inside. So this pH maybe goes up to 8, whereas outside it might be 7, right? Because you have less protons in here. So nature doesn't like that, have such a gradient. Here's just a schematic idea of this pump. This is somewhat altered. I made it an improvement last night compared to what we've used for the last years. So I really didn't understand this diagram so much myself, the way you have it now on your handout. So you might want to print this one out. So you have a protein complex, let's say, that can bind, has a binding site for a protein. Now when it binds, and that binding site is available only from the inside. Now when it binds an electron, there's this conformational shift which closes off the inside and opens up the outside right around where the proton is. This is a very simplified view, but is the basic idea of how pumps work. Right? So once this electron is on here, now the protein is in this conformation, only open to the outside. Now you just let diffusion do its work, just as you did here. The binding was just by collision and diffusion. And then it gets trapped, the hydrogen ion, and then by diffusion it will release on the outside. Then the electron leaves to go to the next component of the electron transport chain, and without the electron, it's not in this conformation again, it goes back to this conformation where it can accept another proton. So this conformational shift takes energy, and that's the way that these packets of energy inherent in the taking off the electrons from the NADH in the first place is captured by several pumps all along the way. The result then, if we just took a snapshot, would be, from what I told you so far, is that there's more hydrogen ions outside than inside, as indicated in this modification of your handout picture. And it's this gradient, which has potential energy in it, just analogous to pumping up against, getting a potential energy against gravity of pumping up water, let's say behind a dam. So you have like 10 times more water, well, a height of a certain 100 feet, whatever, behind a dam. And then you're going to harness that energy now by letting the water fall back through the dam, where, if it were Boulder, Grand Coulee Dam, whatever these hydroelectric powers are, where they would turn the blades of a turbine, which would move magnets around some wound wires and induce an electric current in those wires, and you get you're changing that water potential gravitational energy into electrical energy. So this gradient of hydrogen ions is going to be used to harness energy not as electrical but as our old friend ATP. What kind of crazy scheme is this? You know, substrate level phosphorylation, that's not a term I've used. The kind of phosphorylation you get in coupled reactions, as we saw in glycolysis, or even on the bottom of the Krebs cycle where that GDP goes to GTP, that was really easy to understand. This is a very more complicated way. And the idea that there was this gradient and that these pumps were working like this was first formulated in the early 60s. That was fairly recent, right? And as things go, by Peter Mitchell. And Peter Mitchell was this guy working in England, and he proposed this. And everybody was looking for the squiggle P somewhere that was going to transfer its phosphate onto ATP. Nobody believed this. This is very fanciful. And he had trouble getting funding for his research. But luckily, he was financially independent, lived in an estate in a big mansion, and built a laboratory in his basement. And did experiments that convinced him that this was right, right. That there was a chemical gradient built up, not just a chemical gradient, but also because these are ions, protons. So there's a lot more plus outside or a dearth of plus inside. So you have an electrical gate gradient. And we put those two together. Both are forces that can be, or sources of energy that can be harnessed, both of these gradients, and so they're put together as a combo electrochemical gradient. I did this. So let's now take, just, we don't do this too often, we did it for the Amundsen experiment, I guess. This is not a methodology thing, but just some of the evidence that's in support of this since 1961. So it wasn't accepted until much later, and then, of course, Mitchell got a well-deserved Nobel Prize for this. So if it's true what he said, then if you took electron transport complex, if you could purify that, which you couldn't do in his time, his was just all insight and intuition, that now we can prepare, for example, purified complex 1. If we put the purified complex 1 on one side of a little membrane, to make a little pinhole, actually, this is greatly exaggerated, in a vessel that's separated with this divider, and on one side, first you prepare the membrane by letting these complex 1s attach to one side, and then you wash off all your excess, so now you have this situation. And see if this works, yeah. And now you put in some hydrogen ions on both sides, equal. So nothing's moving, but now prediction is if you would add this potential energy, presence of oxygen, if you add NADH, then it should pass its electrons to this complex 1. Actually, it doesn't get the oxygen here. Pass its electrons to complex 1, which should induce these conformational changes and change this complex into a pump and pump hydrogen ions from the right side here to the left side. And that's exactly what you find. So that aspect was confirmed very directly. Another kind of experiment is you could take mitochondria, purify them away from the rest of the cell, and you can, and then you can break them into small pieces using, in this case, not a blender, is not strong enough, use like sonic energy, like a sonicator. And you get little pieces of membrane, which in the presence of water, because they're hydrophobic, will tend to form little spheres or vesicles, and some will look like this. Some will have these on the outside. For the purpose of this argument, let's have a vesicle that's made with the little lollipops on the inside. Ah. So it is through these little lollipops, which I didn't mention in my picture of the mitochondria, that we're going to harness this energy. These are going to be the turbines in the analogy. By letting the hydrogen ions flow back through these lollipop structures, that's how it's going to be captured. And so that aspect of it was tested with this vesicle experiment. The vesicles were formed in a solution that had ADP and inorganic phosphate, but no ATP. So now we just change the pH. You're not going to do pH 1. Everything would be denatured, but you can make this, say, you know, pH 6, right? Whereas you made the solution, say, at pH 8, right? It's fairly mild. and so by mass action now, these hydrogen ions are capturing the gradient that normally is produced by pumping. Here you're doing it by just manipulating it in a test tube. So in this situation, we should see perhaps ADP and inorganic phosphate combined to form ATP, and it's exactly what is found. So this aspect was also confirmed. And in an experiment that gives you sort of insight into what's necessary and is present in some of your problems, right? A pharmacological experiment was kind of done. Dinitrophenol, so there's the structure. Use this as a drug. 2,4-dinitrophenol. So phenol is a benzene ring like this, 6-carbon with an OH. It's got a couple of nitrate groups. And that OH turns out to be kind of a weak acid with a pK around 7. Right? So it will become ionized and lose a proton because of the nature of everything that's attached to it here. It has more electronegative than a normal OH. And when the hydrogen ion is a little bit high, it'll take it on, and if the hydrogen ion is a little bit low, it'll leave it. It will lose it. So the other thing about dinitrophenol is that because of this benzene ring, it's pretty soluble in membranes and hydrophobic areas. So it will freely pass, even though it looks a little polar to me. The fact is, it will pass through the mitochondrial inner membrane with ease and just diffuse in, doesn't need a channel. So if you would take mitochondria, say, or even cells, right, and look at their ATP production, the prediction is here that outside the mitochondrion with the high hydrogen ion concentration, dienophenol will pick up this hydrogen. It'll start like this and pick this up, go through the membrane, and then inside the mitochondria where the hydrogen ion is supposed to be, hydrogen ion concentration is supposed to be low, it will give it up. So here's these mitochondria with their electron transport chain constantly pumping them out, trying to build up this gradient and letting those electrons, letting those protons flow back through those lollipop structures. Right? But here's this guy coming in and just stealing them and just ferrying them through the membrane and putting them back in. So the gradient can never build up. It tries to build up, but this put in a lot of dienophenol. So it just short circuits the whole business. Right? The proton gradient is destroyed and no ATP is produced. Electron transport chain is still pumping away. That has nothing to do with this. It's doing its job trying to produce this gradient, but the dienophenol is subverting that process. So this experiment also supports the idea that all of this ATP production is dependent on this gradient, and the gradient has to be formed by pumping and by the selective flow of these protons back into the mitochondrion only through the channels that were designed to take them, this lollipop structures. There's Peter Mitchell getting his Nobel Prize. Here's what I should have had earlier. Instead of calling them lollipops, which generally is not an accepted word outside of this course, the real name is F0F1 complex. And it's here where, in fact, the ATP will be produced. Because this is the harnessing of that gradient. And we're going to talk about that now in some detail, ATP formation. ATP that's made through this process, harnessing the energy of this electrochemical gradient, is called oxidative phosphorylation. To distinguish it from the other kind of phosphorylation we already learned about, which was at the level of substrates giving up a phosphate or taking on a phosphate. That's called substrate level phosphorylation, SLP, and this is oxphos. So two completely different ways of making ATP. Just one more picture. These cristae going inside the mitochondrion. So the inside of the cristae is actually the outside of the cell, right? There shouldn't be a little line here. This is all continuous. This is a phospholipid bilayer, right? Membrane. So here's the electron. Here's the electron transport chain. So it stymied me for a minute. So this is inside the cell. Here are the protons inside the cell being pumped out by the electron transport chain, and here they are flowing back into the cell and getting ATP to form inside this F0F1 complex. It's called F0F1 because the F0 part is the stem and the F1 part is the head of this structure. What about E. coli? E. coli, do they have mitochondria? Mitochondria are bigger than E. coli. So E. coli is too small, and that was part of the reason we chose E. coli is it's simpler. And in fact, it's simpler in this respect too. This whole process, which is universal, plants as well as yeast and people, and E. coli. E. coli doesn't have room to put in any mitochondria, but it absolutely needs this selective membrane that will only let protons flow back through the F0F1 complexes, and it has to have a membrane which has electron transport chain components for pumping out. Easier to see here. And so it uses the only membrane it has, the cell membrane. Often bacteria like E. coli actually have a pretty complicated cell wall. They even have a couple of membranes and then something called a periplasmic space that's sort of analogous to the space between the inner and outer membranes. Most books will talk about the hydrogen ion concentration building up in this space between the two membranes, and even in E. coli, between the cell wall. But it seems to me the cell wall and this outer mitochondrial membrane have pores that are so large that it doesn't make sense to me to talk about it that way. That's why I like to think of it as more there's a lower concentration of hydrogen ions inside. For E. coli, they just pump them right out of the cell, right into the medium, right? You can think of it. Now, they don't get very far, all right, because all this is very fast. And the sooner that they're outside, then they're likely to bump into one of these F0, F1 complexes and get back in. So we can think of it as the hydrogen ions right outside, but I think for understanding the mechanism, that's not necessary. It's necessary only that there be a gradient, and we don't care how far it extends outside. Okay, so a nicer name than saying, I think, F0, F1, which doesn't mean too much, is ATP synthetase, or ATP synthase, some say. This is where the ATP is going to be produced, and this is its structure, which has only been apparent in the last maybe 10 or 15 years. So a lot of hard work has gone on, including, you know, X-ray crystallography of pieces of this complex, and to have this quite, I wouldn't say it's, you know, so complicated, but it does have a number of working parts here. We're going to talk about them. How does that work? How do we get ATP out of electrons flowing back in here? So now we have pieces that we can talk about. The main ones we'll talk about are alpha, beta, gamma, and C. Alpha and beta represent two subunits of proteins up here, and there are three each of them. There's three alpha-beta complexes that sit around the central stalk, which is the gamma subunit. So they form like sort of a cylinder around it, but in intimate contact with this elongated protein called gamma subunit. The gamma subunit, on the other hand, is firmly attached to this series of this protein C, which is this series of alpha helices that are spanning the membrane. That's the F0 part. And then there's other pieces that hold the whole thing together. This gamma is not firmly attached to alpha beta, but it's kind of stuck in there, in the F1 part. And it's sticking into the inside. Here it is upside down, not just to be nasty, but because all the labels on this picture, which I liked, only make sense if you hold it upside down. But I think you can sort of do that in your brain and reverse it. So here's the outside now. This is always sticking on the inside. And here's an artist depiction of this transmembrane C part. There's the connection to the gamma, which is just outlined here in a black outline. And here's the alphas and betas that surround the gamma. Okay, so we have an idea of the structure. More, now we have an idea of what's going on. We start to understand. I'll start to tell you. From the outside, here's this C subunit is going to be the place where the protons are binding. They enter through A, and then they're passed to whatever alpha helix right here is right next to A at the time. These are all very similar to each other. Once that proton now binds, again we have this conformational shift business. Right? So just like these, reminiscent of the allosteric inhibition, right? You get a shift, and that shift causes this cylinder here to move in one direction about a tenth of the radius of this cylinder, of the circumference of this cylinder around. This gamma subunit, which I said is not firmly attached to alpha or beta, but just stuck in there, is not a smooth rod, but rather is like a cam. I don't know, those of you who don't know cams, cams like sort of an asymmetrical pusher, like an ovoid or an egg-shaped thing at the end of a rod. There's a cam in your engines, the gasoline engines open and close valves. So as you turn it, it can actuate things because it's got a certain length to it. So when it turns, it disturbs because it's not smooth but has this projection in one direction. It's going to distort the alpha-beta subunits in here. So here's the alpha subunit. Here's the hydrogen ion coming in, getting transferred to its little binding site here in one of the C domains, right? On this cylindrical C subunit, and you get this movement. Once this proton gets to a certain point inside the cell, right, it's turning like this, inside the mitochondrion or the cell if it's E. coli, then it just diffuses off and is lost. But meanwhile, another one has bound right next to it. So you always have this constant flow of binding, distorting, and leaving. Let's take a look now at what's happening to the alpha beta subunits from above. So here I've drawn the alpha beta together. There's six subunits, three alphas, three betas, three alpha betas. I've drawn alpha beta as just three different colors, but they're equivalent of like wedges of a pie here. And what's shown here is that these alpha beta subunits are where the ATP and phosphate will be bound, which are the substrates that will produce ATP. And they can have three conformations. Here in the center is the gamma subunit seen from above. And you see I've drawn it, just made up this points and bumps on it. So to show that there are different distortions, depending on where this cam or gamma subunit is sticking into the particular alpha beta subunit we're looking at, it will induce a particular change. If it's this sharp point, it will be this change, this part. If it's this dull point, it'll be this kind of structure. And if it's no point at all, it'll have this sort of relaxed structure. So this would be the relaxed structure, just open, right? just flat. Okay, let's just look at one of them, the purple one at top. So in this loose binding mode called L, the structure of the alpha beta subunit is such that it's able to bind loosely ADP and inorganic phosphate. And they're a little distance away from each other. Now, as the protons go through and the cam is turned, now the sharp point is up here in the purple area, and the ATP and the phosphate are just squeezed together. So it's like a little machine. I mean, it isn't like a little machine. It is a little machine. Under this condition, where those electron clouds are right next to each other, in a way you could think the concentrations are like, you know, off the wall, ATP is formed. Where's that energy coming from? Energy is coming from moving this cam and causing this distortion, which in turn is caused by binding those protons, which in turn is caused by the electrochemical gradient, which in turn is caused by blah, 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 eating glucose. Okay, now the cam's still turning because these protons keep flowing back. And so now you have, say, the dullest point of all here, you get this relaxed configuration where there's no binding site for anything, and so the ATP just goes off. Right? Now the cam turns again, and we get, once again, the loose binding configuration, which is the same as this. So we're right back here. And it keeps turning and turning, and ATP and inorganic phosphate keep binding, and ATP keeps being formed. What's happening at the other three? Exactly the same three. Same thing, but 120 degrees off in phase, right? So while this one is releasing ATP, this one's about to bind. This one's making ATP. So we're getting, for one turn of the cycle, we're getting three ATPs made. And one turn of the cycle takes about, this number is soft, about 10 protons to turn. There's usually about 10 subunits. That varies in different species. So about 10 protons to turn one full cycle, 360 degrees, I'm going to get three ATPs out of it. How'd they figure out something like that, right? So now that everybody had accepted in 1980s and 90s, the Mitchell hypothesis has been well established. There was a big attack on all the structures. And the people who were looking at these structures came up with this idea of turning. If you want to look at the structure of a protein, you have to look. I mean, proteins are tiny, right? Even these with many subunits. There's nanometers, 10, 50 nanometers, 30, 20. E. coli is what? 1 micron, so that's 1,000 nanometers. You can barely see it. I mean, you see it in the light microscope. You can't see much detail. You can see down to about a half or a quarter of a micron in the light microscope. Otherwise, you have to use electron microscopy. Then you can see even molecules, right? with some difficulty. You can see proteins as kind of blobs. But you can't see any of this dynamic idea. In the electron microscope, everything is fixed and dead and attached to a slide. So there was a kind of experiment that was done to see if whether this rotation idea actually takes place in this sort of fancy machine. And this is called the motor experiment. Why is this upside down? All right, this is upside down. So they purified actually not the whole ATP synthetase, but they cut off these parts, the C and the A, and I think the B, anyway. And they turned it upside down, that is. They put something on the ends here which could attach to something else that's on a glass slide. So all of these ATP synthetases are sitting on this glass side, immobilized, with their bottom of their gamma unit sticking up, because they, as I say, they deleted this thing right here. Now, using more biochemical tricks, they're able to attach to this gamma subunit something like a flag. So we want to see if we can see this gamma subunit actually turn. So, but this is, how can we see it? We have to use an electron microscope. We can't see anything turn. We have to let things sort of be in a native state. We have to use a light microscope where you can look right into an aqueous solution. So they attached something really big, big enough to be seen in the light microscope. Actually, you couldn't see it because the proteins are kind of transparent in a light microscope. You know, they don't absorb any light. So what they did was, the flag they're going to put on here is going to be colored in a certain way. What they used was a polymer of the protein actin, itself about a 40,000 molecular weight globular protein, but it has the ability to form these long fibers and is present in your muscles and it's an architectural unit of cells. So here's 10 nanometers, so this could be maybe, actually I just made this up, but I don't know how long the flag was, but it's of the order of probably 100 nanometers, maybe 200 nanometers. So it's pretty long, actually. Attached to this little gamma subunit, this whole thing is only 20 nanometers itself, and this one looks like, well, I put these together. I don't know exactly. It was probably around 10 nanometers here also. So they attached it here, and that's my picture. Here's their picture. And I've added these green things, which is the fluorescent small molecules attached here. So the whole thing fluoresces if you shine the right kind of light on it. So you can see it, actually, in the light microscope. Just, you can see the light. You can't see the molecule, but you can see it's giving off light by fluorescence. Now, how are they going to get this to turn? It doesn't have the C subunits. It doesn't have the membrane, because that's just too messy and complicated to do in a test tube. What they figured is, let's put ATP in instead of ADP and phosphate and just reverse the whole reaction. So now this looks like the other diagram, but it's different in that the arrows are in a different place. Right? So all of these reactions are reversible. If we load up our slide, solution bathing the slide with ATP, then everything can run more in the opposite direction. There's nothing churning. The cam is not attached to anything except this flag, but it's not being driven by anything anymore. So we took away the C subunits. So the cam is a passive thing here. So if we add ATP and you have plenty of water, you can get hydrolysis of the ATP. It'll push the water, worm its way in, push these things apart, and distort our purple AB subunit up here so that it goes from this tight to this loose, and that's going to force the cam to move in the opposite direction, right? Counterclockwise. Before it was moving clockwise. Now it's going to move counterclockwise. And etc. So the idea was it would go along. There might be some problems, like how do you get this guy now to bind ATP? It occurred to me when I was modifying this diagram last night. So you might have to wait. Maybe there's an equilibrium between these two. Wait until the binding site is formed, then get the ATP. But you don't have to wait too long, maybe. Just maybe milliseconds, or, well, let's see. Let's see if this works. Yeah. I think I need the mouse. Let's see. That's the result. You can almost see it stopping at 120 degree intervals around this 360. There, stop, waiting, going around, counterclockwise, just as predicted from driving this reaction backwards. So this is a kind of a dramatic, this is my favorite picture in biology. It beats even mitosis for me. You have links to, actually I'm doing fine, so maybe I'll show some more movies. So here's now a picture that puts this all together. So you have the hydrogen ions coming in, here's the C subunit, and the ATP being produced by the distortion, by the CAM of the alpha-beta subunits. Here's taking place in the mitochondrial membrane in the matrix. It could be taking place in the cytoplasm of E. coli, where these things are pointing in towards the center of E. coli. And you find it also in chloroplasts. What's this thylakoid lumen? We haven't talked about photosynthesis. But ATP during photosynthesis is going to be made the same way. So that's why I told you that, in fact, there's a lot of commonality between the capture of energy from the sun and the capture of energy from glucose. The main difference is getting that sunlight converted to produce an electrochemical gradient, same as this. Once you have the gradient, then it's the same. Here's some pictures. This is something called atomic force microscope, which kind of traces the outside of a molecule. These are the C subunits they look like. Yes, C subunits. And here's an artist's rendition of the C subunits taking on these protons and changing and getting this movement that goes around. I mean, it's an artist's rendition, but it actually has the correct proportions of these backbone of the protein subunits as our domains, as they're shown here. This looks extra. Here's another view with a ribbon diagram of the, look at all those alpha helices, kind of little tiny alpha helices glom together. Here's the gamma subunit. This is seen from above. And if you'll click on this in the web lecture, you'll get a... And it doesn't seem to work here. Let's try it anyway. Yes, working. QuickTime better on this computer. So this, I mean, although this is drawn, the movement and the positionings of the CAM and the alpha-beta subunits are taken from isolated structures whose crystal structure, whose structure has been determined. So that's why they can make a picture like this. Or if you have a space-filling model, same thing. I can't quite figure out why there are three colors, but I think probably this green and red is all one subunit, like alpha, and then the yellow is beta. And if you look closely, you can see that there's a big movement, and then there's a little more subtle movement right there. There's a subtle movement. A big movement opens up closer, and even closer. Probably that's the ATP formation when they got even closest together. Okay, enough of the movies. Well, there is one more movie that you can click on that just puts the whole process together, looks inside, outside, and it's quite a nice animation. I forget what it's called, but it's one of the four that are in the that are on the web lecture, the HTML version. Actually, also works in the PDF version. Okay, so let's do some accounting now. How much ATP are you going to get out of all this? So each of the complexes 1, 3, and 4 that takes electrons from NADH pumps enough hydrogen ions to allow the formation of one ATP. Each does. So all three of them working together should produce three ATPs. So you get three ATPs, and again, this number is, you know, is an approximation, but you know, it's not one, it's not five. It's probably between 2.5 and 3.5. So you get 3 ATPs per pair of electrons that pass through, 3 ATPs per oxygen atom that accepts those pair to become water, 3 ATPs per NADH plus H plus, that is, donating those 2 electrons and getting reduced. However, only 2 ATPs from FADH2, that one place in the Krebs cycle where we had to use, where we did use a different oxidizing agent. So how does that work? Here's our old Krebs cycle, and here's the step where FAD takes place. If we look at the energetics of that reaction, it's kind of interesting and kind of gratifying to see how evolution has adopted the best strategy. If we look at the reaction, succinate goes to fumarate, which is what we want to do here. If we use NAD, we'd have to go uphill, right? Because it's not as big an energy difference. It's not as good oxidizing agent, right? See, this is that 53 kilocalories per mole all the way down to water. So on this scale, it's not higher than succinate. But FAD is, I mean, actually, it is. There's not as much of an energy difference between succinate and NAD than between succinate and FAD. So this reaction would be kind of a bottleneck that would have to build up by mass action. You could get around it, just as we got around it in glycolysis by pulling the reaction from subsequent energetically favorable steps or pushing it by building up succinate. But things work more smoothly if you have this bigger energy difference by passing the electrons from succinate to FAD, which is a more favorable energetic reaction. And there's a whole separate subunit then that's been comes into play just for this purpose, and that's where we use the FAD. But because the FAD is now lower compared to oxygen, you're not going to get, if you go instead of 1,3,4, if you go 2,3,4, you only get enough protons pumped to such that when they flow back, they only contribute 2 ATPs formed. There it is. Now we go back to this figure, and we understand now complex 2, which is inserted here. And this is the one enzyme, the one enzyme of the Krebs cycle. I told you the Krebs cycle was in the matrix here, but actually succinic dehydrogenase is actually part of this subunit and sits on the on the outer part of this integral membrane protein and passes its electrons to coenzyme Q. So that's going to help with our counting. Here's a, on your handout also, on graphic 28, is a, handout 8.6, is this outline of energy metabolism that puts it all together very nicely, I think. And here we're considering the amounts for half a glucose. This is a complicated PowerPoint slide, I must say. So it doesn't look like much on your printout, but behind it, there's lots of things going on. We're going to consider half a glucose. Instead of one glucose giving two of everything, we'll consider, you know, conceptually a half a glucose. Right? And you might say, well, why do we want to switch and force you to think that way? Because, you know, we're always fighting the memorization scheme here. So to say one glucose gives this, you know, if you have to think about half a glucose, you have to sort of figure out where things are happening. So there's also a didactic reason for doing half a glucose, I think. Although I didn't draw this. So we get up here, glucose going to pyruvate. We're going to get ATP produced by glycolysis, by substrate level phosphorylation. So let's do our counting over here. Substrate level phosphorylation, 2 ATP for this name, substrate level phosphorylation. Remember, we're dealing with half a glucose. Threw me for a minute. I thought there's only one for half a glucose. But this is all of substrate level phosphorylation. So it includes, in the Krebs cycle down here, here's oxaloacetate citrate, it includes the one that's produced down here at the bottom of the Krebs cycle in the form of GTP. One from glycolysis, one from Krebs. So that's 2. There they are. From oxidative phosphorylation now, we got 1 NADH from glycolysis over here, right? in that oxidative step. One NADH from the entrance to the Krebs cycle. These are all pointed out. Three NADs within the Krebs cycle. You remember that? One, two, three. Back here. One FAD from the Krebs cycle. Remember that? Just talked about it. So, a total of five NADHs, which accounts for 15 ATPs, one FADH giving rise to two ATPs, for a total of 17 ATPs per half glucose from OxPhos. So we got this, 2 per half glucose, 17 from half glucose. So the grand total for E. coli would be 17 plus 2 is 19 per half glucose, or the number that's memorized usually, 38 per glucose molecule. 38. The other thing about this diagram that's nice is that the top of it is in the cytoplasm, and the bottom is in the mitochondrial matrix. Which brings us a certain problem for those of us who are not E. coli and have to bring the electrons from glycolysis into the mitochondria for them to continue in the Krebs cycle. So that's only the case for the NADH that's produced in glycolysis. So it's not going to go down and get to fermentation pathway. It's going, in the presence of oxygen, it's going to go into the mitochondria. To get those electrons, it turns out NADH does not simply pass through the mitochondrial membrane, but rather it gives its electrons up to an intermediate, and the intermediate gets into, and I won't go into what the chemical structures are there. You can read about it in Becker if you want. But it costs you an ATP to get that pair of electrons in. So we have to subtract for these two, now per glucose, for each of those NADHs produced in glycolysis, the two of them, we have to cost us an ATP. So our net, we have to subtract 2. We only have 36. 36, 38, who's counting? Actually, we are counting. But that's not the big difference. The big difference, you'll see, well, the big difference is obviously we got 36 from glucose in the presence of oxygen. We got 2 in the absence of oxygen. So it's a lot bigger yield. But I'm talking about efficiency first. So if we consider the 36, what's that worth? 36 ATPs are worth 7 each. They're worth 252 kilocalories per mole. If you burn glucose, you will release 686 kilocalories per mole, so our efficiency is 252 over 686, about 37%, which is even better than glycolysis and better than most engines. The yield is 36 versus 2, but don't sell fermentation short. You can make do. Many of us can make do if we're E. coli with such a low amount but definite amount of ATP. This ends our discussion of energy. So all aimed at getting the direction of the reactions that are necessary to make the new stuff in E. coli to be in our favor. As we pointed out, one E. coli plus glucose goes to two E. coli. That's an exergonic reaction. And it's exergonic because this glucose is just being ripped apart and releasing its energy, more than enough to make E. coli. But glucose is not the only source of energy we have. So now let's talk about other things we eat that give us energy. Our Big Mac meal here. How about the milkshake? The milkshake has milk. Milk has a bunch of things. One thing it has is milk sugar, which is lactose. It's not glucose, it's lactose, which we know is a disaccharide. We might remember it's glucose connected to galactose. We can always look that up. So there's an enzyme that will hydrolyze that bond, that glycosidic bond. And so it does that, and we have glucose plus galactose. We know exactly what to do with glucose. It goes right into glycolysis. The galactose is not glucose, so it has to be converted. So there's three enzymatic steps necessary to move that hydroxyl that's pointing in the wrong direction, the only difference between galactose and glucose, and get it to point in the right direction so it looks like glucose and so can be acted on by hexokinase and all those other enzymes. Nevertheless, we get the glucose out of it in three steps, and so we know what to do with that. What else we have here? The bun. Bun has starch in it. Poly-alpha-glucose is starch. So again, the first thing we do is hydrolyze it. In this case, we get out, we don't actually add water, we add phosphate to it because there's energy in those bonds. And we can get with no cost glucose-1-phosphate directly from the cleavage, concomitant with the cleavage of the glucose-glucose bonds in this monotonous polymer. Glucose-1-phosphate, however, is what comes out. That's not what we need. We need glucose-6-phosphate if we're going to enter glycolysis. And so there's an enzyme that will isomerize, essentially, the phosphate group, change it from the 1 position to the 6 position. They're not that far apart in the ring. And once you have glucose-6-phosphate, you enter glycolysis now at the second step. You don't have to invest ATP. You save 1 ATP if you eat starch. Better than eating glucose. Lettuce has this polysaccharide, the plant cell wall, cellulose polysaccharide, polybeta-glucose. What do we do with that? We don't do anything to it. We have no enzyme that will cleave the beta configuration, as most organisms don't, right? Only certain bacteria, right? cows and horses can do it because they team up with those bacteria in their stomachs. So the lettuce just passes through us as roughage. French fries. What do you say, a starch? No, you eat French fries for the fat. That's why you eat it. Fat all over their surface and sunk into them. Greasy French fries, how do we deal with that? This gets more complicated, okay? First thing we do is we take this triglyceride, which is drawn a little oddly here in a stolen diagram, but of course it could spin around over here and look like this in space. So we have carboxylic acid ester bonds, and then the hydrocarbon chains. So we have, this is a lipid, and we hydrolyze it with a lipidase, or lipase, as it's really called. So we take this triglyceride, and we break it into its two component parts, glycerol and fatty acid. Glycerol, we talked about last time. A couple of steps, it enters glycolysis at the hydroxyacetone phosphate, and then continues merrily along glycolysis and Krebs cycle. How about the fat? The fat's more complicated. You've got this long hydrocarbon chain with an N here, notice, and it's got this carboxylic acid N. First thing you do is you invest a little ATP so you can attach this coenzyme A that we saw in the entrance reaction to the Krebs cycle up there and make fatty acid or fatty acyl CoA, right? That's a high energy bond there, actually. And we used ATP to create it. Now we're going to take out a couple of hydrogens. This is the alpha carbon, then we're going to start from beta to gamma. Beta oxidations. It's called beta oxidations, located also in the mitochondrial matrix. Because succinate, when we wanted to take those hydrogens off with their electrons, off of a CC bond instead of these easy C double bond COHs, we use FAD to make that reaction more favorable. So we oxidize it with FAD. FAD takes the electrons, becomes FADH2, and we have our double bond there. So these hydrogens just moved over to here. The next step in the scheme is add water right across those bonds. That's not an oxidation or anything. We just add water, and we always add it so that the OH is not on the beta carbon, but is on the gamma carbon a little distance away. Now we'll do another oxidation. This time it's an OH, so we can use NAD. Take away these two hydrogens, and we have a ketone over here next to an acid group. And finally, we cleave it by adding a CoA molecule right here. Take advantage of the energy in that bond. So it doesn't cost us anything. Doesn't need an ATP anymore. And we get the rest of the molecule with CoA attached, and this guy is freed up CH3 now as the H from the SH of the coenzyme A adds here. You have CH3CO-CoA. That's just acetyl-CoA. And we know exactly what to do with that. Right into the Krebs cycle. Now we're left with a fatty acid. It looks very similar to this first intermediate here, the CoA version of the fatty acid, except except it's minus 2. Because these two, we just repeat the whole process. Enzyme just looking at the end of it until if we have an even number of carbons, we just end up in the end with a, and there's a problem like that to deal with in the problem book, you just have acetyl-CoA in the end. If you have an odd number, you get some three-carbon thing, you deal with it. What else? Hamburger, the protein. Whoa. We get energy from protein, you bet. We get plenty of energy from protein. First thing we have to do is knock it down to its amino acids. For we have a lot of different amino acids. We've talked about some of them used in the lab, but they're derived from our own pancreas or stomachs, where they're secreted into the stomach, trypsin, and then some more steps until finally you get all free 20 amino acids. The stomach acid, now it can be as low as pH 1, helps also. You can't really hydrolyze it that. It takes more acidic treatment than that to hydrolyze the polypeptide, but it denatures the protein, making this access to these proteases very easy. Now, each of the 20 amino acids is going to have its own particular pathway depending on its structure. But they do have something in common. Because they have nitrogen, none of the intermediates, Krebs cycle and glycolysis, have nitrogen. They're going to have to be, they're going to have to be dealt with. So let's talk about how nitrogen is dealt with. There's one kind of reaction that's common to almost all the amino acids, right? And that's called transamination. So let's say we want to get energy out of alanine. We've got some alanine from our hamburger, and there's the NH2 group. We have to get rid of it. So we bring along an acceptor of that amino group, and that's going to be our old friend, alpha-ketoglutaric acid. See? I can still say it fast. We're going to exchange the NH2 from the alanine for the C double bond O at one end of this alpha-ketoglutaric acid. I said when we met this, it looks a little like glutamic acid, and indeed the product is with the NH2 here instead of the C double bond O, it's just glutamic acid, another amino acid. But our alanine has been converted to pyruvate by putting a C double bond O here, another old friend. So we're seeing these same characters again and again. Pyruvate then can enter energy metabolism in the Krebs cycle, right? Give acetyl-CoA, etc. Of course, we've only kind of passed the buck here. What are we going to do with this glutamic acid that's got this amino group? Pretty soon, all our alpha-ketoglutaric acid is used for this. So we'll have is glutamic acid. Krebs cycle will stop. And we'll just have a lot of glutamic acid. So there is one reaction that's common throughout nature. And some organisms, there's two like this. But for us, humans, for example, this is the only case we can really get rid of the nitrogen. And that's an oxidative deamination rather than just this transfer or transamination. It involves adding some water, doing an oxidation with NAD. So there's right away we're going to get some energy out of this, right? NADH2 can go into electron transport chain. Right? And the NH2 gets water added, becomes NH3, and the oxygen would be OH, but we have oxidation going on at the same time, so this becomes C double bond O, and we have back our alpha-ketoglutaric acid and free ammonia. If we're E. coli, that free ammonia just goes off into the medium where it's greatly diluted. It doesn't bother it. If it's us, the ammonia is not so great. It's kind of toxic. So we combine it with CO2 and put a couple of these onto a CO2 molecule and we get urea, right, which goes into urine, right, and we excrete it. Not 8 molar urea, which is going to denature us, but, 1 millimolar urea. So if we add these two together, we started with alanine. We see that we put in alpha-ketoglutaric acid here. We got it out here so that the net reaction, and we used the glutamic acid, we produced the glutamic acid here, but we used it over here. So our net reaction was alanine goes from these two together. Alanine goes to pyruvate plus ammonia. So we're cool. How about something more complicated than alanine? So simple. Well, phenylalanine with this ring and stuff here. So phenylalanine is a little more complicated. First, in fact, it's built up to tyrosine by some hydroxylase reaction, right? Phenylalanine hydroxylase. You get tyrosine. It's very similar to phenylalanine except for this OH. Then that's a substrate for a transaminase. So we take away the amino group, just as I showed you for alanine. You get the C double bond O. and you can put this name on it, hydroxyphenylpyruvic acid. And then there's more steps, steps, and you get fumarate and acetoacetate, I think that is. you don't have this, I don't think, on your... That's acetoacetate, which is like... it's like what would be left of a fatty acid when you're down to four. It's like acetic and acetic together, acetoacetate. Yes, here it is. Acetoacetate then can be broken down into two acetyl-CoAs, going to Krebs. We got over here somewhere fumaric acid, not shown, but in the course of this we get fumaric acid, goes into Krebs. So both of these, all, as this ring is taken apart down here, yeah, here's the fumarate, not shown, the detail's not shown. You see the point, you don't remember the details here. You can always look them up. You can look up in any biochemistry book, how is phenylalanine degraded? Some people are born with a deficiency in this enzyme. And as a result, they build up phenylalanine, which drives a wrong reaction. I guess the phenylalanine gets high enough to work with an enzyme that probably, I'm speculating here, has a pretty high KM. Normally it's not a problem, but if it's driven, you can get a side product, phenylpyruvate, which is injurious to the development of your brain for some reason. So people who don't have this enzyme can have severe mental retardation, but now, as you know, this is phenylketonuria, or PKU, and all newborn children are tested for it, and if you do have that deficiency, you can just get around the problem by making sure you don't eat too much phenylalanine, a low-protein diet. So let's take a step back and see what's going on with all these reactions. What we see is sort of a general principle in catabolism, that starch, fats, and proteins, they all get degraded to small molecules. Usually they're monomers. I mean, not always. Yeah, I guess it's always the monomers in the end that built them up in the first place. And the amino acids themselves broken down in sometimes simple and sometimes complicated ways, but always resulting in the players we've all met from this central flow of glucose and energy metabolism, either glycolytic intermediates or Krebs cycle intermediates, and that's where they produce energy. So they just enter these pathways at various points and go on from that point on. And so you could figure out how much energy you get from anything, and that's often a problem on examinations, right, to see if you understand what's going on. All right. So we can get energy from all these things. Now, how do we really put this, how do we actually run those reactions that require ATP in general and that are the anabolic ones, the ones where we're making this red stuff in our logo to make two new E. coli? Biosynthesis. That's called anabolism. And those reactions have their pathways that sometimes use some of the same enzymes and sometimes special enzymes. So glucose has to be built up, for instance, for us in the storage form of glycogen. That's going to take ATP. Acetyl-CoA, you're going to build fats for storage and membranes, right? And amino acids, monomers have to be formed so we can make proteins. So let's consider this now. So here's our old diagram, and we're looking at, first, let's consider how you make the monomers that are going to be the substrates for making the polymers, the monomers. Here. Let's just give a couple of examples. Fatty acids. Now, this looks similar to the fatty acid degradation. It's actually a different set of enzymes, same intermediates, but notice the arrows are in a different place. Right? So I do it this way, so I think it's easier to follow, because you can follow it, you can compare it to the catabolism. Here we have a Krebs cycle running that produces, or actually the first reaction of the Krebs cycle, producing acetyl-CoA. Now you take two of those acetyl-CoAs that are so produced, that's a high energy bond, we can connect them together, split off a CoA, and now we have a four-carbon keto version of acetyl-CoA. This is in fact acetoacetate, right? And now instead of oxidizing, we're going to be reducing. We want to reduce this so we can get down to a hydrocarbon, get rid of these electrons. I mean, add electrons so we can get rid of this oxygen. So here we use, let's say, NADH2 and put those two H's on, and now we have an OH and an H right across this bond, right? And this has been reduced to NAD. Well, I left out the P. So this is a little bit different than NAD. It's got an extra phosphate, as you can see. And it's sort of specialized more for these biosynthetic reactions. So the enzymes, that it may be easier for them to sort out whether they're doing biosynthesis or whether they're doing catabolism. If they have preference, often you can substitute somewhat. But if they have a preference for the NADP, it means we're on a reduction path. We're using this for reduction, not for oxidation. And we're building something, right? Now we just take the water away again from between the two carbons. So all the reverse of what we did before. And now we have our C double bond C. And now we reduce that. We're going in the other direction now, so we don't have to use FAD, right? It's the NADPH2 again. And add hydrogens across here. And there we are with this little tiny fatty-like acid, right? It's not really a fatty acid, too short. But we just keep repeating then this procedure. Take another acetyl-CoA, a two-carbon module, and build it up until we're as long as we want to be. How do we know when to stop? Nobody knows for sure. But stop they do at around 18 or 14 or 20. Okay, said all that. How about synthesis of a typical amino acid? Let's use serine, it's easy. Glucose goes along in glycolysis. At one point, it makes 3-phosphoglyceric acid. That's a glycolytic intermediate. You can even check your glycolysis if you don't believe me. It's got this phosphoester group on the top. So we work with that one. It's already got a phosphate on it. It's got a phosphate on it, rather. And in this case, we oxidize the OH to C double bond O. So you get this thing, this 3-phosphohydroxypyruvic acid. See, if we had hydrolyzed this phosphate, we'd have an OH. And so if this were CH3, it would be CH3COCOOH. That's pyruvic acid, so it's hydroxypyruvic acid, and it's 3-phosphohydroxypyruvic. The name makes sense if you work through it. Now we do one of those transaminases that we use for catabolism. In this case, the same enzyme can be used. We're going to get it from glutamate, again, the general donor of these in this direction. And the glutamate will become alpha-ketoglutarate, which is fine. And and we're going to get now an NH3 here instead of a C double bond O. And so here's the backbone of all amino acids, alpha carbon, amino, carboxyl, is over here because this was glyceric acid. And on the end here, we still have this phosphoester bond. Well, we just hydrolyze that, phosphate off with a phosphatase. The PI comes off, and we're left with the basic part and CH2OH. So, all right, it's more complicated if you want to build phenylalanine, but basically the same business. A whole bunch of steps. Usually some of them require ATP. There's NAD involved, NADP involved. And in the end, we get this, which is not exactly like your handout. I couldn't find this thing anymore. But yours is a little easier to read than this. And essentially, they have all. Notice in the middle here, this is the Krebs cycle and glycolysis. And it's very much like the simple diagram, except this has got it all. All the things that happen. Here, I just zeroed in on this blurry picture. Here's here's serine, right? And I can't read it. 1,3-diphosphoglyceric, 3-phosphoglyceric acid, 3-phosphoglycerate. And there's our steps to serine. So all of them are on this pathway. Okay, and that's how the monomers. What about the polymers? Lipids. Okay. You can make glycerol. Again, from, I won't take time actually to go through this in detail, but you can make glycerol from glycolytic intermediate dihydroxyacetone phosphate, just like you get that if you start with glycerol. Then to the glycerol, you can add the fatty acids. We just showed you how we made those. And so you can make your triglyceride. No problem. You just need a couple of enzymes, right? Phospholipid, you can also make. You see, actually, the glycerol already has a phosphate on it, so you're on your way with phosphatidic acid here. Take the phosphate off if you want to make a real triglyceride. What about polysaccharide? All right, this is a complicated example. But I let you study it on the PowerPoint. I think you have a different version, maybe. No, this is the version on your handout. Hyaluronic acid. It's another, that's a polysaccharide that has a COO minus group, much like on their exam. This glucuronic acid, and it hooks up with acetylglucosamine. I choose this because it's more complicated than cellulose or starch. It's got two different guys, and they're all decorated. So you have to make the monomer, decorate it with COOH, decorate it with N-acetylglucosamine, and you want to have them alternating. So you have a chain that's got N-acetylglucosamine, and you add your glucuronic acid. It's got this group to facilitate the energetics, and you make that connection. Now, once you made that connection, you have to put another glucuronic acid on it. I mean, you have to put another N-acetylglucosamine because this is already glucuronic acid. So you need at least two enzymes. Probably that's all, one enzyme to activate it. So maybe three enzymes, you can make this more complicated varying. And even if you had three different ones, what would you need? Three or four different enzymes. No problem making these polymers. Enzymes do the trick. How about proteins? Let's say we want to make hexokinase, and this is its structure. Met, val, his, lu, gly. So let's take met and have an enzyme that takes met and puts on val. So now we have met val. Okay, now we need something that recognizes met val and puts on histidine. So now we have three. Now we have another enzyme that has to have specificity for met val his and put on leucine, etc. Problem is, if we want to put exactly the right amino acid in, the enzyme has to recognize what's been the intermediate that's being built up as a substrate. Since hexokinase, let's say, has about 500 amino acids, we would need 500 enzymes to do this job. So this is getting rather complicated. Right? There's 3,000 different proteins in E. coli. Let's say each one is 500 amino acids as an estimate. Then we need 1.5 million enzymes to make those proteins that were specific. Well, 1.5 million is a big number. But it's not a gazillion, right? Maybe we could have that. Trouble is, these 1.5 million enzymes, each one is a protein. It has to be made. So we see it's hopeless. We need something else. The problems we met in making E. coli, first, getting reaction rates to go so things can be made fast enough. That was enzymes. Then we needed the reactions to go in the right direction. That was energy metabolism and all these metabolic pathways as part of that to get that energy metabolism. But for the information now, to make the system give us specific three-dimensional enzymes which have all this information, how do we know how to put those together? The answer, of course, is the nucleic acids, which we haven't touched yet. And Professor Mauschwitz will continue with this interesting story. I'll still be around to proctor your exams. Here she is getting a prestigious award for teaching, so you're in for a treat.